Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
My name is Ed Camo here on Campus Firewatch Radio, and this month we're going to be starting with Battalion Chief Steve Sapp from the Columbia Fire Department in Missouri, which is home to the University of Missouri. In 1999, there was a devastating fire in a fraternity that claimed the life of Dominic Passantino. Steve and his colleagues have been working on trying to get a mandatory retrofit sprinkler ordinance in place following this fire, and recently they were able to get one passed by the City Council, or so they thought. The Greek community has launched a really concerted campaign to overturn this ordinance, and Steve is here to join us to talk about what they're doing and how to counter this effort and what you can do to help Steve and his efforts in Columbia. Then we're going to move on and be joined by Dr. Doug Sullivan Gonzalez, who's the Dean of the Honors College from the University of Mississippi, which had a fire that killed three students in a fraternity in 2004. Alcohol is a factor in so many of the fires we see across the country, and many schools are taking efforts to try and combat this problem. The University of Mississippi assembled a task force to look at the problem, and Doug, who's also a firefighter down there, is going to discuss the findings of the task force and its implication. Then wrapping up the show is a fascinating discussion with Dr. Carol Higgins, who's the Director of Counseling and Consultation Services at Butler University in Indiana. She's going to talk about what makes today's millennial students tick. The millennial generation is a complex group, and reaching them with fire safety messages is something that requires creativity and a really radically different approach than what we've done in the past. And Carol has some absolutely great information on how you can design your fire safety program to try to reach this really complex group of people. So let's sit back and listen to Campus Firewatch Radio on Radio at Firehouse.com.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, joining us today on Campus Firewatch Radio is Battalion Chief Steve Sapp with the Columbia Fire Department out in Columbia, Missouri, which is the home of the University of Missouri. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Good morning. Thanks for having us, Ed.
Recently, Columbia Fire Department's been successful in getting a mandatory retrofit sprinkler ordinance passed for Greek housing, which you probably thought that was the end of the story, didn't you, Steve?
Well, we were certainly hoping it was, and we were very happy to get it passed.
Why don't you fill us in a little bit on, first of all, why you even went about getting this ordinance passed in the first place?
Well, this dates back to about 1999 when we first started working with the University of Missouri and the Greek Life system to try to improve our campus fire safety education message. And it was just 2 weeks after we had held an initial meeting with the university officials that tragedy struck. We had a fatality fire at the Sigma Chi House, which is located on College Avenue in Columbia. It was an early morning fire. Dominic Passantino, a freshman at the university, lost his life in that fire. And I think that was really kind of the impetus that told us that this was much more serious than what we thought originally it was. You know, we were looking for ways just to kind of go out and talk about general fire safety to this group, but it really taught us a lot that this group of young men and young women are at much more risk than what we ever imagined. And so this got us down the path of how can we not only improve education, but how can we improve their living environments to make sure that this doesn't happen again on our campus.
And so just like a lot of other communities, you were successful in getting through an ordinance that would call for mandatory sprinklers in Greek housing, weren't you?
Well, we spent a lot of time, Ed, looking at some of the other communities, notably, of course, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and then some of the other Big 12 colleges, such as Oklahoma State, Iowa State, University of Colorado at Boulder, and kind of molding our ordinance around their successful adoptions of ordinances, and, of course, their successful adoptions of having the sprinkler systems installed. And as we modeled it around that, we worked hard, we thought, to include the interested parties, the members of the Greek Life community and so forth, to provide us input and so on. We looked at a lot of sprinkler contractors to try to pinpoint cost for what this was going to mean to their financial bottom line. And we looked at some of the fraternities and sororities that voluntarily had installed automatic fire sprinklers in their buildings and what their cost and what their feelings about the installation were. So in 2005, 2006, we really thought that that was our time to include this amendment into our ordinances, because we were moving from the 2000 International Fire and Building Codes into the 2006. Made sense to do it. We held a lot of public open meetings, and really we had affirmation by silence from the Greek community that we didn't feel that this was going to be a big issue, because they simply were not present at the meetings and voiced no written or spoken opposition at any of these required open meetings. And that unfortunately changed the night that this whole package was sent to the council for adoption, which was in January of 2007.
And they'd been pretty much involved, or at least made aware of what was going on all along. It's not like you guys did this in a vacuum, did you?
Well, we felt that we were really very open about this. You know, Columbia Fire Department and the University of Missouri came to a contractual arrangement about 7 years ago now. We're one of the few municipal fire departments and universities that actually have an assistant fire marshal that works for the Columbia Fire Department contracted out to work with the university 20 hours out of the week. They're assigned to their environmental health and safety division, where we actually go in, and even though the university property is state and it's sovereign from the fire codes, we go in and we're allowed to do inspections, monitor fire alarm systems, conduct drills, and so forth. And then on the other side of this individual's job, this assistant fire marshal's job, is that we then assign them primarily to the other two private colleges we have here in Columbia that have populations of less than 1,000. And we also assign them to the off-campus and Greek communities. So we've got this direct liaison back and forth. The liaison met with both the board members and the House presidents on numerous occasions, indicated that this was going to occur, encouraged input. And so we thought we had really done our job. Of course, all the meetings that we had over a year-long period were required by Missouri Sunshine Laws to be advertised and open. And again, just the affirmation by silence, we just did not think this was going to bring up the storm that it has.
And one of the key people in helping make it get through was Dominic Pasentino's mother, wasn't it? Donna Henson.
Well, Donna Henson has just been a great champion of fire sprinklers here locally and, of course, across the country now with the Common Voices Coalition. And she came and provided some tremendously powerful testimony in January of 2007 when we went to the council with this amendment. And I think that her testimony, of course, as you can imagine, help move the council to do the right thing, and that was adopt this ordinance as it stands. As a matter of fact, there was much discussion that night when some opposition cropped up, and after hearing Donna Henson's testimony, I think it far outweighed the economic factors that the fraternity and sorority members were bringing up, the burden that the financial was going to give to them. So, you know, we're kind of back in a way to square one now, where we're going to be bringing this back before the council probably in January of 2008.
So obviously the opposition has surfaced. They've managed to get it brought back up again as an issue. So what happens now?
Well, what we've been doing over the past year now is trying to meet with some of the members of the fraternities and sororities that are opposed to this. We've had a number of public meetings. We have what's known as a Board of Appeals, formerly known as the Building Construction Codes Commission, that has heard testimony from both parties, and unfortunately in November they drafted a recommendation to our city council to repeal the ordinance in its entirety, which would mean that it would be stripped off the books if the council takes that action. What will happen now is that a report will be made to the council at their first meeting in January of 2008. They will then set some times and dates to discuss this. A public hearing must be held on this issue. And so what we're hoping for is that we will be successful once again, and we have been trying to reach out, again, not only to the Greek community, but to all the advocates of fire sprinklers in fraternities and sororities and off-campus housing to voice their support of this ordinance. And, you know, we've just had a tremendous outpouring. I talked to the city clerk's office a couple of weeks ago. The city clerk indicated that over 50 letters of support have been received so far, and she wasn't surprised that more might be coming in. So we will go back with this fight to the council, and it is a top priority for us to maintain this amendment so that we can protect those lives of those young men and women over there and take the burden off of parents of not hopefully ever having to lose another child, at least on the University of Missouri at Columbia campus.
What's their argument for opposing it? What's their rationale?
Well, it all boils down to financial, and of course I've been in the Fire Marshal's division and work with the contractors and builders for a number of years now, and it always boils down to cost. We fight constantly to have sprinkler systems installed, and of course, as you know, codes mandate certain square footages or occupancies or occupant loads before sprinklers are required, and it's just amazing how many times architects and contractors will come in with numbers just below, and when I say just below, I mean just a hair below what would make a system required. So it's always money, and you know, it's easy to look at a direct cost and say, well, this is too much, but you know, we just can never go back and put that cost back to a human life, and not only to that individual that may lose their life or individuals, but to all the suffering and so forth that goes on with the families and the firefighters and everybody that was involved in that incident. And it's just a huge cost that no one ever thinks about. We've done quite a bit of research. We've talked to a number of sprinkler companies that do installation work, and then companies that come back and do cosmetic work to conceal piping and so forth. Some of the figures that we've heard touted by the fraternity and sorority members are upwards of $300 per square foot. That simply is not the case. We've got a number of sealed bids back on a number of buildings here in Columbia, and we're looking at somewhere between $250 and $3 per square foot.
And I know that the insurance company, obviously, for the Greek housing, too, supports the idea of sprinklers and has reminded them, too, that they get a break on their insurance for the installation of sprinklers. And I remember talking to Rich Barr, who's the fire marshal out there in Lawrence, Kansas, that, again, when they did it, they had the same argument, cost. But they passed it through anyways. And he said not a single Greek house went out of business because of finances related to the sprinklers. They went out of business for other reasons.
Correct.
But it wasn't because the sprinklers just broke their back.
That's right. And I've known Rich Barr for a number of years and have been in, of course, telephone contact with him on several occasions. And they've just had outstanding results with their amendment and with their ordinance. And so have the others. You know, there's not been one unsuccessful sprinkler ordinance. As you said, there may have been a fraternity or sorority that have gone away from the campus, but again, it's usually because of poor membership. It does not really have anything to do with the financial impact that's related to sprinkler systems. So, you know, we'll just continue the fight. Just this morning, we had a fire alarm at one of the fraternity houses. Our assistant fire marshal that's assigned as the liaison was about a block and a half away, arrived on the scene, and not one single person had begun to evacuate that house. We still had people in the dining areas that were ignoring the alarm. We had people that were asleep on the second and third floors ignoring the alarm. And so this is one of the arguments that we have brought up time and time again, is that while we understand the importance of fire alarm systems, they are simply a reactionary device. You have to take the appropriate action. And because we require fire drills, witness fire drills each semester, we see time and time again that the students just don't react properly to these alarms. But having that fire sprinkler system in place and working, we know that the chances of them dying in a fire are going to be reduced by over 85%, according to national statistics. So we just continue this fight to make sure that the safety of these young men and women is the best that it can possibly be. Because as I said earlier, we simply don't want to go through what we did in 1999 ever again.
Well, really appreciate you fighting the good fight out there, Steve. I mean, I know it's not easy, and you know, I'm sure the people listening will be glad to help you out any way we can. And there'll be a link on the page below where if you want to send an email or send a letter to the city council, which a lot of people have done, showing your support for the idea of a sprinkler ordinance in Columbia, Missouri. I think that's part of what helps make your cause, doesn't it, Steve?
It absolutely does. And again, I just want to express our thanks to everybody who has already taken the opportunity to send letters of support. And for those that haven't, if they would just take a few minutes, we certainly would be indebted. And I know that a number of young men and women that are here now and that will be here in the future, and their parents will be indebted as well.
Well, we've been talking with Steve Sapp, who's the battalion chief for the Columbia, Missouri Fire Department, about the problems they're having with their sprinkler ordinance. They thought they had it passed, and now all of a sudden the opposition has arisen on it. And he's filling us in, and you too can play a part in this. So look on the page below, click on the link there, and show your support for what they're doing there in Columbia, because, you know, fighting the good fight anywhere is fighting it everywhere. So thanks a lot, Steve. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Ed, for the opportunity. We appreciate it.
This is Ed Camo on Campus Firewatch Radio on radio@firehouse.com.
radio@firehouse.com.
And joining us on Campus Firewatch Radio is Dr. Douglas Sullivan Gonzalez, who's Dean of the Honors College from the University of Mississippi. Thanks for joining us, Doug.
It's great to be with you, Ed. Thanks for inviting me.
Doug and I met a few years ago, 2005, when they had a terrible fire down there at the university where three students were killed in a fraternity fire. And it was just a terrible tragedy, but got to know Doug pretty good. He's also a firefighter down there, so he has a great perspective on fire safety when it comes to the campuses. And one of the issues that the universities looked at is that of alcohol, because it was a factor in that fire, and as we have learned in many of the fires that have occurred over the years, it's a factor in a number of fires, fatal and non-fatal. The university put together a task force to look into it, and Doug was on that task force, so I was wondering if maybe you could just fill us in a little bit on what their findings were.
The task force was formed in October 06 to address the culture of alcohol, especially the illegal and irresponsible consumption of alcohol. And we discovered quickly that, one, we're part of a broad-based grassroots movement across the nation. We're not the only ones. Ohio State, Harvard, Princeton, University of Georgia, University of Florida, all having similar problems with similar consequences. Kids underage especially take risk, and those risks play out in very fatal ways. And we've had our share of fatalities here at the University of Mississippi. Most notably, we had a young student in October who was involved in the homicide of an officer because of his consumption of alcohol and other illegal substances. Before that, I think it was August 04 when we had our fire, our ATO fire, that left three young boys fatally dead, and all three, the reports showed, had some level of alcohol in their system. And we decided that the university's got to take action to protect the educational environment. We were not taking action to express, to stop or to halt responsible and legal consumption of alcohol, but to protect the project here that we have to hold in common goal to educate ourselves and our kids here. So we've pursued a threefold strategy, I think, that's worked well to this point, though there certainly have been significant bumps. One is to make people clearly understand they're responsible and are going to be held accountable if they violate our policies on campus. That is, we've instituted, we think, a very novel two-strike policy. If someone is convicted of two strikes, that is, of illegal consumption or possession of alcohol on campus, they will be suspended for the semester, the current semester, and the semester following, so up to a full year suspension.
That's pretty aggressive, isn't it?
Yes, it's very aggressive, and I can tell you at the beginning of the semester, fall semester, five students had already been suspended with two strikes. And the message was clear. My students in my classes spoke to me clearly that they were not going to take the risk of facing mom and dad and a suspension of possibly potentially a full two-semester suspension. That two-strike has also been applied to at least one fraternity on campus that violated the policy. So not just individuals, but institutions are held to the same high standard. Two, we were going to follow the law as best as possible. It's a very complicated law for us in particular, and this makes us unique, that the city and the county have overlapping boundaries, and the laws for consumption are very different. And so we've tried to then institute the third form of strategy is to communicate our message as clearly and forcefully to our constituents, which are our students, our staff, faculty, and our alums, and those in the community that support us, so that they would be encouraged to uphold others to the same standard. Because we know a police effort's not going to make it. This has to be a real movement up where the community stands up and says enough's enough. We want the Grove, the gathering spot, probably our most famous public space on campus for great activities, cultural as well as athletic activities, that we're going to protect that space for families and make this a great place and continue to make it a great public American university.
Now, is it a case of there is more drinking, or is it just more awareness and perhaps less tolerance of it?
Is it the case for the accidents or the case for the new policies?
I mean, when it comes to alcohol in general,
I tell you what the stats, I think, indicate, the national statistics, which we're fortunate to enjoy the hard work of many institutes out there. In particular, we've seen that drinking as a whole across the nation is going down. What's interesting, though, is the at-risk behavior is skyrocketing. We all know that alcohol consumption begins at an early age, 13, 14, and binge drinking is already instituted in place, and that's a five drinks in one setting for male or four for female of hard liquor. And getting behind the there appears to be a sense of greater safety that students are taking more risk getting behind the wheel of a car or any other type of behavior that results in a tragedy or severe accident that they regret. So we know that at-risk behavior is on the increase, and we've noticed other institutions have faced a sort of a similar flashpoint in the last 5 years. The national, if I can remember correctly, sort of the national grassroots movement really takes off in 98 and 99 when two deaths due to alcohol poisoning affects one SEC school, LSU in particular, and another school in the nation, which escapes my mind at this point. But that's when it began. So we're in a 10-year process. University of Mississippi's had three or four highly publicized instances involving fatalities and drinking and then the fire itself. That's forced us to really sort of hone in and try to reflect critically how we can better prepare ourselves and educate ourselves.
And drinking really has been a culture in colleges across the country. I mean, it's just one of those things that was, I'd almost say accepted. You know, it was almost a rite of passage for a number of years that you went to college and you drank and I mean, I remember my days, and it still happens today. And as a matter of fact, they just had a death down at Clemson University where a fraternity brother was found inebriated and died, and I think he had five times the legal limit of alcohol in his blood.
Unfortunately, that's too common. It is perceived by many families to be a rite of passage, and this is where, to tell you the truth, the real point of attack has to be junior high and high school, where kids begin experimenting heavily into consumption. And parents who facilitate that behavior, I think ultimately are going to be held responsible for that behavior, and it won't be too long before that, I think, is more the case.
Well, you'd mentioned that students are really sitting up and taking notice. I mean, are you seeing a change in terms of the accidents, the injuries, the deaths, things like that that are attributable to alcohol?
Unfortunately, the honest answer to that question is relatively we've had at least two public deaths since the institution of the policy have been directly affected by alcohol. And the committee said, you know, once we feel like success, we can claim success is when we pass through a year and there are no alcohol-related deaths. Unfortunately, that's not been the case. And so we consider ourselves at the beginning of a very long culture to address this issue. Now, you need to know that Mississippi, strangely, was one of the first states to pass a prohibition back at the beginning of the 20th century and one of the last to repeal it, but we had a higher consumption rate than many other states. So we have a culture, we've inherited a culture of hypocrisy. And what we've tried to do with our new policies is to recognize the drinking takes place. And we're saying, look, legal drinking's fine if you obey the law. Illegal, irresponsible, you'll be held accountable. And that's what we've tried to do, and that's going to take time. The changing culture is going to take time.
Now, in doing this study and as part of the task force, you'd mentioned you would look at other schools and talk to other schools. So do you feel that, you know, you're kind of facing the same problems as everybody else, or is Mississippi kind of an exception? How does it look on a national level?
Well, one of the good things that the committee recommended and the administration's wholeheartedly supporting, we're going to measure alcohol consumption and illegal abuse consumption as good as the data can get on a yearly basis, and we're putting a lot of money into that. I think within 5 years we're going to see if the stats that we have is just relatively white noise or if it's a real significant trend, and then we'll know. The stats that we find is we're on average in terms of drinking and we're above average on binge drinking. And of course it's binge drinking where you get the problems, and we're unsure of our data. And I'll be able to better answer that in 5 years from now, I think.
All right. Well, I know that many more schools are really taking a closer look at this for a variety of reasons. I mean, up here at the University of Massachusetts, which is where I went to college, they've really cracked down on it because after the World Series, after the Super Bowl victories and things like
right.
that, students were out there partying, and it was getting very violent, and they were lighting fires, and people were getting hurt, and they took a no-tolerance attitude. They gave them the warning that if you are caught doing this, if you're observed doing this, and if you're underage, you know, you're in serious trouble. It's very similar to what you had.
I think you can see the ramifications of similar discussion in the rest of Lafayette County, where the University of Mississippi is located, which, you know, when you visited, you met some of the guys involved in the volunteer, Lafayette County Volunteer Fire Department. The many students participate in that, and the students push for a no-tolerance policy at the county fire department with alcohol soon after, you know, these tragedies. If any young firefighter or elderly firefighter has consumed alcohol and is convicted DUI, suspended automatically. and, mm-hmm. and may lead to and must reapply at that point. So we've seen very positive results of others saying, look, we've got to change this. So that wasn't pushed by the university. That was young men and women who've seen what's happening and what others are doing have responded to the challenge.
Well, on the webpage here, we're going to have some links to the task force report that's available on the university's website, along with some other resources when it comes to college-age drinking and the behaviors. And there's just a wealth of information out there, and I know that it's something that everybody is struggling with. That nobody really seems to have the magic bullet or the simple solution to it, because it is a complex issue.
Yes.
All right, well, Doug, really appreciate you joining us. We've been talking with Dr. Douglas Sullivan Gonzalez, who's the dean of the Honors College down at the University of Mississippi, about their alcohol task force findings. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Ed, a lot of us really appreciate the work that you've put in. You've raised our awareness to the number of the issues that we must face as a university community to make our community, state, and nation stronger. We appreciate your investment and all your work you do.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your kind words. Well, you're listening to Campus Firewatch Radio on radio at firehouse.com. My name is Ed Camo.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
And joining us today on Campus Firewatch Radio is Dr. Carol Higgins, who's the Director of Counseling and Consultation Services at Butler University. Thanks for joining us, Carol.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me.
Carol and I are working on a project to develop a fire safety training program for students, and certainly one of the challenging problems is reaching out to today's generation, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. They go by the name of the millennial generation, and Carol and I have been really talking about what makes this generation so different from those that are ahead of it, and maybe you can fill us in on just what are some of those unique factors about today's students.
Technology drives a large part of who the students are and how they relate to the world. In fact, there's a great article that just came out in the New Atlantis, a journal of technology and society, about friendship networks. Instead of having the burden, possibly, of going up to someone, meeting them, getting to know them, and all of the things that you used to do back in the old days to establish a friendship, you can now be connected through a friend of a friend of a friend. And it eases, in essence, how you get connected to others. And I think that's the issue with this generation in technology is you have your whole music collection with you in your hand in your iPod or your MP3 player, and it's always with you in your ear at your discretion. You have your Bluetooth on your ear that you can engage in a conversation whenever you want. You can document the world by clicking a picture with your phone again whenever you want, or running digital and documenting the world. So the world is instantaneously accessible to you and you to it for the younger generation, which causes some ripples and disconnects with older generations, but we'll talk about that in a minute.
And this is a generation that grew up with this technology, whereas you and I had to learn it. It's just been a part of their daily life, hasn't it?
It has. I'll out myself. I'm 47 years old, so I'm technically the tail end of the baby boomers or the very beginning of the Generation X generation. And if you look at Generation X, which is about early 60s to 1980s, they were the first generation that had the little Macintosh computers on their desks at school. So they would be the first generation that started to grow up intuitively dealing with technology, and they would be the first generation that started to know about the internet, whereas millennials don't know of a world without the internet, and you and I know of a whole world that functioned just fine without the internet, and we're getting used to what it is and how we relate to it.
Since they have just been so used to the technology growing up, how has this changed how they receive information? I mean, one thing we certainly notice is their attention span is shorter.
Yes. Bits of information, if it's not enticing, if it's not audiovisual, the overhead projector still exists in higher education and in educational settings. But students now want to be engaged in all their senses, and that's a curse and a blessing. It forces you to condense the information, but we run the risk of having a lot of breadth but not a lot of depth with information. And it's tough because if you have access to everything, you have the illusion of, I can always go back and get that later, but will you remember to, or will something new come up? So it's a rapid world. And in some respects, I think it also is an anxiety-producing kind of world, where if you can get something now and you should get something now, then you're possibly in a heightened state of anticipation. And also then that leads to, if you're thwarted, how well do you deal with not getting what you want when you want it? We all have to deal with that, but our timelines are different, I think, depending on when we grew up.
And with the sea of information around them, I mean, are students more prone to go seek information, or do we have to deliver it to them?
They're going to seek it, but they're going to seek it in their ways, and we have to deliver it in their ways. So one example that has come up recently is campus notifications of emergencies. If there is something going on, there used to be officers that would block off roads. There would be personnel that would be targeted per building that would go from building to building to let people know there's a situation at hand and here's the emergency plan. Over the last year, we have an example of Virginia Tech, and in response to Virginia Tech, large land-grant universities, large universities such as Purdue University most recently, rolled out a notification system where they have captured the instant messaging and text messaging addresses of as many students as possible and faculty and staff, so that now when there is an emergency, not only will they send something out on the phone network throughout the university, but now they're instant messaging and sending text messages to get to students because they know that's where students are connected. And then students start looking in different places. If they want to know something, they won't wait for someone to tell them. They're going to go out and they're going to go to trusted resources and access that. So they may go to friends to say, who do you look at for valuable information for, let's say, a health issue? And if they say, well, it's WebMD, then they'll go to WebMD, possibly bypassing speaking to a real-life person who may be available to them. So it pushes us to refine our message and be as creative as possible in giving a broad array of options to be found, and then also encouraging students to look as broad and far and wide for reputable resources on where information can be found.
Now, one of the things you just touched upon there is the viral aspect of information today.
Yes.
That it's just getting, you know, word of mouth used to be a thing that, you know, your generation and mine used, but now it's just almost instantaneous and broad-based.
Yes. And there's an issue of trust. In reading about the social networking groups, it's an interesting conundrum between the people who participate in these social network groups feel that there's an element of trust that they can trust to a certain extent who is in their environment and the messages that they're being given. But if you ask them how truthful are they, a lot of people say they actively misrepresent themselves for shock value or for a way to be noticed. So it's interesting that we're relying on our colleagues for valued information, but depending on where we get it, it may be suspect before we even get it out into the public.
Let's talk a little bit about fire safety, and you mentioned earlier kind of the disconnect that occurs between generations here because of the way we learned how to use technology versus this generation, which has grown up with it. And I think that's really comes to the forefront with fire safety in terms of there's the old tried and true way of teaching fire safety versus how this generation gets their information.
Yes. What we relied on, and if you think back to your college experience, when you were dropped off at your university, I'm sure that you underwent all the meetings. So this is the meeting where you learn about how to go out and access the community safely. Here's how you lock your doors down. Here's how we exit in the case of a tornado emergency. And here's what we do in case of a fire emergency. And this always involved long policies and procedures and written things and role-playing and reenactments in the moment with staff, taking a lot of time and energy to do it. Now we look at universities, and there's so much information that is available and is necessary. We need to know how to prevent sexual assault. We need to know how to prevent robbery and other issues. One of the many, many issues that are covered is fire safety. But where do we put it now? And where do we say it is valuable enough, which it absolutely is, to gather a group of students who are hard to corral because they are so busy and so pressured in their time commitments to go through the role-playing? And I think the beauty of the training that is being developed is it will be accessible when students want it, on their own recognizance of, I'm just interested because I want to be safe, but also it is an elegant solution to being timely, engaging, and informative for students in a relatively short time span, and they can load it on their iPods, they can watch it on the web. So we've tried to make this information portable and accessible, and I think that is going to be what's necessary.
So is that really one of the keys to any future training, is really kind of on demand versus being delivered the typical standard, you sit in a classroom or you sit in a meeting sort of thing? It's got to go to an on-demand world.
I hate to say this, but if we think about your kids, or I'll think about my nieces and nephews, if I have a choice between them waiting to have fire safety at the beginning of the academic year when they first come to university, when we drop them off, or I have the option to say, before you go to college, let me give you this link. I'll sit and watch it with you, and I hope you go back to it time and time again. But before you go, can we review this? Because I'd really like for you to know it, even if you go over it again when you hit the university. Of course I want to be able to access it before they go.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things we had talked about earlier was the role that parents do play in today's generation. I mean, I certainly remember when I was growing up, when I was 18 and went away to college, you know, that was kind of my time to cut the ties, so to speak, and be on my own. And that's not quite the case with this generation, is it?
No. If you ask younger students, grade school, high school, junior high, they will say that their parents are their heroes. And that makes a good amount of sense if you think that families are smaller. 40% of millennials are firstborns, and 10% of millennials are only children. And when you have family dynamics like that, who are you hanging out with? Your parents are your friends. Your parents are your social network. It's not like you have a bunch of siblings to hang out with. You're hanging out with your parents. Well, you know them more, and you relate to them differently. And I do believe that Boomer and Gen X parents have been different. They want their children in their lives longer, and they relate to them. So what's happened is, we've also had a shift in social programs. Things that big structures used to take care of, education and special programming, have fallen to the wayside as we've had a lot of budget cuts and shifts in values and priorities. And what I've noticed is parents are stepping up to the plate and saying, this will not fall through the cracks. I'm going to advocate for it. And then we have parents who we euphemistically call helicopter parents, but these are ever-present parents, and they're going to make sure that the ball doesn't get dropped. So what I'm thinking is, this is going to be the wave of the future, is that we've always worked in tandem with our educational structures. I think we're going to lean more on parents because parents want to be leaned on. They want to be there, and they want to make sure that their children are as safe as possible. I think this is one of the avenues we can use to capitalize on getting the message out.
And there's certainly more influence that parents have in the students' lives nowadays. I think it's probably indicated by how you told me earlier, the students are just in constant contact with their parents during the day, you know, because of the technology, the cell phones.
Oh, absolutely. Students are calling their parents about interviewing for an on-campus job. Help me write this paper. In fact, I have a lot of parents who've gotten really great grades at college after their degrees are done because they're editing papers. They're not writing them. They're just doing really wonderful high-level editing for their students. Mm-hmm. And it's not that students, I want to stress here very strongly, that it's not that our students are slackers, that they are layabouts, that they are not rigorously doing what they need to do. These are smart students. What they know are, they are resource managers. They are taking what is a lot of demands that they are juggling, and if they've got somebody who's stepping up to say, I'd love to help you out, and they trust them and value them, which they do with their parents, they're going to relegate some of that work to them, and they are going to get the help. So students value their parents in ways that are different than we've seen before. Parents are involved in students' lives longer. We've extended adolescence. There are a lot of boomerang students that leave university and go straight home, not because they can't make it, but because they're trying to maximize making it in a different economic climate. And that, again, continues to strengthen the connection with parents. So parents will continue to have a lot of presence in our students' lives, and the students do value them. Of course, there are individual differences, which we will always find, but it seems to be a larger proportion of students who are positively connected with their parents longer.
So maybe as we wrap up here, you can just kind of summarize, okay, I'm a campus fire safety officer, and I'm trying to create new, different, innovative programs for the students. What are some of the key things that I should be thinking about when I'm trying to reach out and touch a millennial generation student?
Well, you're going to try and think, who am I getting? So where have they been before I've got them? They've had stop, drop, and roll when they were younger, but have they had any updated information that is current? So you're going to think, do I need to catch them as they're coming in the door? Absolutely. You hope that parents who have gotten wind of this project will have shared it with students who are younger in ages. So hopefully in a few years, by the time they come to a university, they'll say, oh yes, I know this information. My mom shared it with me, or my grandmother, or my aunt. Someone gave me this information, and I already have it. So one avenue is see where we can embed it in earlier education through schools and or through parents. Then peer network. If these students are firstborns, which means they're leaders, or they're singletons, which means that they've had play groups and they use, this generation is hugely peer referenced. Let's use positive peer referencing, that quote social norms campaign or the viral marketing, to have students sign on, to get a cadre of students who get it, why this is important, and have them start spreading the word with their younger colleagues. And then the last group is make sure to check back with your faculty and staff who might find the way that we're delivering the message interesting, and in the byproduct, they'll learn something that they may not know themselves. We can't assume that all of the reasonable authorities have the information that they need in their own way. So if we catch the kids who access through their peer networks and through direct technology, that you hand them a CD if they absolutely don't have it any other way, or they can get it through the internet, or through their peers who say, hey, if you're going to move off campus and if you're going to live with me, I don't want you as a roommate until you've reviewed this fire safety thing, because I don't want you burning the house down and hurting me or someone else. So that's pretty much the big three I'm thinking of.
Well, great information on how to interact with today's generation, which I'm sure not only a lot of fire safety officers, but parents want to know as well.
Yeah.
Because it is so much different with all the technology and the way they interact with the world. So I really appreciate you joining us today. We've been talking to Dr. Carol Higgins from Butler University. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much.
And we'll have some more information on the website below, so if you look on the links, you can get a lot more information on millennial students and some suggestions and ideas on how you interact with them. My name is Ed Comeau, and you've been listening to Campus Firewatch Radio.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.